This is Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we're going to dive into San Luis Obispo County's new affordable housing plan, which some are calling historic.
If we're going to celebrate or pat ourselves on the back for this being historic and a breakthrough and a landmark, et cetera, well, you know, the rubber meets the road with the money.
We'll also hear another portion from our reporting project, like oil and water. And later, we'll dive into one local's holiday baking tradition.
Mom and I started cutting up the fruit and having sticky cherries and dates and everything stuck all the way up your arm, it seemed. And I certainly am very fond of traditions.
These stories coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon and happy holidays. It's Monday, December 17th, 2018. I'm Tyler Pratt. Voters in seven California counties have passed measures banning fracking and placing limits on other types of oil extraction. This November, a citizens' initiative in San Luis Obispo County sought to do the same. Oil companies funded an $8 million campaign to defeat the measure, which divided the county, and ultimately a majority of voters rejected Measure G. The defeat removes one roadblock to a planned expansion of operations at the Arroyo Grande oil field near San Luis Obispo. That field is owned by the Colorado-based petroleum company Sentinel Peak Resources. It bought it from Freeport McMoRan. That's the name locals will remember from planning and supervisor meetings in 2015. The company's planned expansion also hinges on a decision currently before the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. But neighbors of the oil field are concerned about the safety of their drinking water wells, should new drilling and waste disposal wells edge closer to their properties in the coming years. In response to worries over local water contamination, KCBX News started a reporting project into how groundwater science is conducted to understand the basis of how state and federal regulators decide whether or not to allow oil field owner Sentinel Peak Resources to drill more wells in San Luis Obispo County. We're also looking into the factors state and federal regulators use to balance oil industry production with protecting public health. This is part of an ongoing project by KCBX News' Greta Mart, titled Like Oil and Water. This project is in part funded by a USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism grant.
Laura Bjorklund was washing dishes when something caught her eye out the window above the kitchen sink. In a pasture where the family's horses graze, a fountain of roiling black oil was shooting into the air.
There was a geyser of oil coming out of the ground. It was like Beverly Hillbillies, 10 times over.
The year was 1981, and the oil was coming from a nearby oil field called Aurora Grande, or Price Canyon. It's named for the canyon and thoroughfare it straddles between San Luis Obispo and Pismo Beach. As the San Luis Obispo Tribune reported at the time, a pool of oil 30 feet across formed in the pasture. The article says a company engineer traced the problem to a nearby oil pump. 3 weeks before the leak, the company had started injecting steam at the pump to ease the oil extraction process. It was the early days of enhanced oil recovery techniques at Aurora Grande. To fix the problem, the engineer said workers planned to, quote, cover up the pool with topsoil and reseed the land so it could revert to pasture, end quote.
They sent all these trucks and it was a huge fiasco, you know. But then when they tell me that the layers are impermeable, I don't believe them because this can happen in my pasture.
When Bjorklund says she doesn't believe them, she's referring to the current owner of the Aurora Grande oil field, Sentinel Peak Resources. Continuing a plan started by a prior oil field owner, Sentinel Peak is working towards drilling hundreds of new and replacement wells in Price Canyon. That's so it can keep the 100-year-old plus oil field producing. Those new wells are partnered with a proposed expansion of the area, known as the Aurora Grande Aquifer, where the oil company can send wastewater underground, tripling its current size. In order to move forward on the project, Sentinel Peak needs what's termed an aquifer exemption from the United States Environmental Protection Agency. That exemption will excuse that underground area from the National Safe Drinking Water Act.
The oil company's application is currently before the EPA. Oil companies have been allowed to pump their wastewater into porous rock formations deep underground as a disposal method since the 1930s. What precisely is in the wastewater is not known, as petroleum companies are not required to disclose exact ingredients. The wastewater is called produced water, referred to by the industry as brine or salt water.
Produced water, the most common constituents that you see in it, are associated with high levels of salinity.
Matt Keeling is the Assistant Executive Officer of the Central Coast Regional Water Quality Control Board. He says oil field formations coincide with deep, salty marine sediments.
So things like sodium, chloride, sulfate, and then other minerals that you can have in there as well, and metals. And then depending on the produced water source and what level of treatment it may have undergone, it can have, you know, trace levels of other petroleum-type hydrocarbons because it was at one time in contact with oil. And a lot of petroleum hydrocarbon-derived contaminants have a tendency to be carcinogenic.
Oil companies and the state and federal agencies in charge of regulating the oil and gas industry consider deep underground storage of produced water to be safe, working on the premise that the potentially toxic liquids stay where they are, quote, injected and don't move underground to other areas or aquifers. Neighbors of the Aurora Grande oil field worry that the wastewater from the injection wells is going to migrate underground to their drinking water wells. A report 3 years ago found there are about 105 domestic drinking water supply wells within a one-mile radius of the Aurora Grande oil field. The oil company and state regulators say it's safe to inject wastewater underground in Price Canyon because the geology underneath the oil field is like a bowl, with the sides of the bowl comprised of rocky boundaries that are impermeable. Injection wells are several hundred to even a couple thousand feet deep, while drinking water wells are usually a few hundred feet deep. And oil companies and state regulators maintain that the underground vertical space, separated by layers of silt and rock, keep the two apart.
Now, obviously, if one was to go drill a water well right next to where they were doing the disposal into that aquifer, then you probably would find contamination. So it was just a matter of separation and space.
Preston Jordan is a research geologist with the Energy and Geoscience Division at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in Berkeley, California. He describes one of his specialties as deep subsurface fluid engineering projects. In all his studies, Jordan says he hasn't found any instances of injected produced water contaminating public drinking water supplies, but
there are events where water has seeped out of the ground surface in relation to water disposal wells, and so one would presume, you know, there's the opportunity in that case for some kind of contamination of quote-unquote groundwater or usable groundwater along the migration pathway that took.
Jordan says in one research project, he compared instances of well failures, blowout spills, essentially any uncontrolled fluid from a well, recorded in state databases, and then those reported in the Bakersfield, California newspaper. He found the data did not match up.
And interestingly, there was at least one blowout I can remember that did have a public impact. I think if I recall correctly, it necessitated the evacuation of a school for a period. And that was only reported in the newspaper. It wasn't in the state data. So from that, and the newspaper captured every blowout that was in any data set that had a substantial public consequence, whereas the state data did not.
So when state and federal regulators say there's no evidence of drinking water contamination from underground injection associated with oil production, it's hard to know if that's actually true. And particularly in the case of private domestic wells, says Jordan. Other organizations, like the Natural Resources Defense Council, say there have been numerous cases of known or suspected drinking water contamination linked to oil and gas production across the country. But again, there's no centralized independent database to consult. But perhaps that will change in the coming years. Jordan is the chair of an independent panel mandated by the California legislature in 2014. The panel is focused on reviewing the state's regulations for and implementation of the Underground Injection Control Program. That's the program by which oil companies are allowed to do underground injection of wastewater. The state regulator, the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, it's called DOGGR for short, is currently in the process of creating new regulations for that underground injection. It's just in the past decade that the state's underground injection program is getting any kind of widespread scrutiny, scientific or otherwise. In 2011, the U.S. EPA censored DOGGR for its lack of regulation over where oil companies were injecting wastewater underground.
In 2014, the U.S. Government Accountability Office criticized the EPA's oversight of state regulators, saying the EPA's nationwide program to protect underground drinking water sources from injected oil extraction fluids and wastewater just wasn't effective. Since 2009, Dogger has acknowledged hundreds of injection wells and thousands of enhanced oil recovery wells were improperly permitted. Those that were injecting wastewater into freshwater aquifers were ordered to be shut in or closed down. But for most of the wells, the agency has worked to bring them, quote, into compliance while allowing daily operations to continue. The Aurora Grande Aquifer Exemption application, currently before the EPA, expands the area allowed by the state for wastewater injection since 1983. That's when the state took over regulation. This was long before it was revealed that state regulation had been inadequate and shoddy from the outset. Dogger officials say the agency has turned over a new leaf, and in recent interviews, they repeatedly pointed to the proposed new regulations. David Bunn directs the state's Department of Conservation, which in turn oversees Dogger.
In the last 5 years, we've completely overhauled the Department of Conservation's division that oversees oil and gas. And we have overhauled our data management system. We've improved our science. And so on our side, I think we're frankly, our regulatory role is a much more sophisticated and thorough.
You're listening to KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. We're hearing a short radio documentary on oil production in San Luis Obispo County. Let's return to Like Oil and Water, an ongoing reporting series by KCBX's Greta Mart.
Adam Peltz is a senior attorney at the Environmental Defense Fund. In mid-September, he submitted comments on Dogger's new underground injection regulations.
The current proposal is already a major improvement on what the state has now. But we're calling for, in particular, better ways of analyzing the integrity of wells on an ongoing basis, because some of them operate for decades and decades. And even if you build it right, if you don't watch to make sure that it's not leaking, you know, everything that you build eventually will break.
And just in the past 2 months, much has been gutted from the latest iteration of the new proposed rules governing underground injection in California. For example, a section mandating monitoring for seismic activity near disposal wells has been eliminated entirely. Meanwhile, in 2016, U.S. Geological Survey researchers published the first conclusive study finding chemicals hazardous to human health in surface water near a wastewater injection well in West Virginia. The study's authors say there are critical gaps in understanding the potential impact on surface water quality and environmental health. One potential threat to domestic water wells surrounding the Aurora Grande oil field is from idle wells. Those are wells that are not actively pumping up oil, but they haven't been officially closed. Even if the wastewater injection wells are working properly, if there are idle wells in close proximity, they can serve as conduits for the injected wastewater to move underground to other areas. Matt Landon is a supervisory hydrologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's California Water Science Center. The center is a program of the California State Water Resources Control Board. Landon works to determine the connections between deep oil and gas activities and deep freshwater aquifer responses. At this point, he stressed, his group really only has preliminary data.
We certainly anticipate that these injection activities, particularly when you combine them with areas where there's a high density of oil and gas wells, some of them which may have been drilled a very long time ago and which were not installed or abandoned according to modern construction practices. So they could serve as potential areas where fluids could leak up into groundwater resources zones.
There are currently 30,000 idle wells across the state. There are 126 idle wells puncturing the Aurora Grande oil field. Landon says it's very difficult to know if there's contamination moving via idle wells from where injection wells are pumping and nearby drinking water wells. One of the big messages of those behind the Measure G campaign is that oil production uses a lot of water resources. Peter Fisk is a geologist and director of the Water Resilience Research Institute at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory.
Clearly, oil and gas production needs water. You need water both during the production of the well, you need water depending on how you're going to pull the oil or gas out of the ground. And of course, water is needed all throughout the process of refining to gasoline. And so water and oil and gas production will always be inextricably linked. And we have to figure out how to close that loop and figure out how to deal with the water that's, you know, a byproduct of oil and gas production.
Fisk is one of 500 scientists and researchers working at the lab's Earth and Environmental Sciences section, and he focuses on how to treat and dispose of water.
I think that the process of injecting wastewater back in the ground is likely to go away in the United States, partly because water is becoming more and more precious. And as the cost of water treatment goes down and the value of water goes up, it may be the case that oil and gas companies actually treat the water right there and end up producing either drinkable water or water that's safe for agricultural use, rather than drilling a hole and pushing it back down.
Going into the future, Sentinel Peak is going to have to use more intensive recovery methods to get the remaining oil out of the Aurora Grande oil field. The creators of Measure G say they may try again to bring an anti-fracking measure before the voters, one that will aim at curbing expanded oil production in San Luis Obispo County. That's as the state moves away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. We have 46 years to reach the 100% clean energy requirement set by the state of California this year. For KCBX News, I'm Greta Mart.
That was KCBX's Greta Mart reporting on oil production in San Luis Obispo County. It's part of her ongoing reporting series entitled Like Oil and Water. Find out more on the series and listen to the entirety of part one at kcbx.org. Last week's San Luis Obispo County employee strike over wages and benefits shined a light on serious issues of affordability in the county. The strike came on the heels of a new, some are calling landmark, affordable housing plan adopted by the county the week prior. The County Board of Supervisors have agreed on a policy to help build affordable homes for the county's workforce. The affordable housing plan was recommended by the Coalition of Housing Partners, and this includes nonprofits, county housing authorities, and builders such as Habitat for Humanity, the Housing Authority of San Luis Obispo, and the Home Builders Association. KCBX's Greta Mart and I recently sat down with San Luis Obispo County Board Supervisor Adam Hill at the KCBX studios. We spoke with Hill to learn more about the new housing plan, what all it entails, and what it means for the county moving forward.
Well, it's a package of things, or as some people are calling it, a suite of options. And, you know, it really kind of begins 10 years ago, where just before I came on the board had passed an inclusionary fee for housing, meaning that developers could either build, you know, low-income housing as part of their projects or pay money in lieu to do that. And the next year, 2009, I got on the board, and the recession was in full force. And we had taken a time out on raising that because it was something that was supposed to be raised every year. By the time the recession ended, the board had changed as well, including the more conservative board basically took majority. And there has been a real desire not to raise it, and even a desire from this current board's majority to kill it altogether, because developers don't like these fees.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about it a little bit more.
Yeah.
So they're building. They decide they build a new housing development.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be market rate.
Right.
They don't want to set aside half of that for low income. They would rather pay this amount that the county sets.
Yeah.
And that goes in a fund.
Right.
And then they're able to build their development. Where does the inclusionary housing law come from?
Right. So, it's all over California and all over the country. I mean, in fact, San Luis Obispo, the city, has a very strong one, stronger than the boards, than the county one, and has been in place for a longer period of time, and it's been tested by the courts and all that, so it's been around for a while. The way we've used it, because we haven't been able to, well, we haven't seen this, you know, in the county, the same kind of housing development also, but a lot of the kind of housing that's being built in the county, they don't really want to accommodate smaller units, less expensive units, so they'll just pay the fee. And so what we've done is taken that money each year and given it to projects, whether they be projects so I've been at ground breakings and ribbon cuttings for projects in San Luis, projects up in Templeton, up in Paso. So there are affordable housing projects happening everywhere. And so the way we've decided to use it is to at least help those projects move forward, help finance them. But as we've been kind of struggling with this, politics really of it more than anything, and understanding that housing is the major issue, not just in our community, but in every community, and that it's really connected to everything here now. You know, economic development is clearly connected to it because we have surveys from our employers telling us this is the biggest issue they have in terms of retaining talent, in terms of attracting talent, is the cost of living is just, you know, obscene. And the housing is just, you know, it used to be, and Cal Poly has the same problem, and probably every employer has the same problem. So we basically said to this coalition of groups that was led by the home builders, who, you know, have a lot of members that are builders and developers that don't like those kinds of fees, the Chamber of Commerce, which represents a lot of businesses, and then the nonprofit housing, from People Self-Help, as you mentioned, to the Housing Authority, to Habitat for Humanity. We tried to get everybody involved, and they worked with a subcommittee of the board, John Pichong and Bruce Gibson. And as things were developing, I would check in with the HBA director and the chamber gal who was representing him, just to see how things, and offering my help from that end too.
HBA means Home Builder Association?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So we were all, you know, and I proposed a year ago that we should set up an affordable housing fund, that we could have a steady amount of money that, you know, I proposed at that point $5 million. But when they came back with this, having worked with a variety of groups and the subcommittee of the board, there were a whole bunch of recommendations, and some that we had seen before in different forms, such as raising the bed tax, which is known as the TOT tax on hotels.
So when you book a hotel room in San Luis Obispo, you pay this
right.
money, and that's the TOT, and it goes into a fund. What is usually done with that money?
Yeah, exactly. So it's used for a variety of things, including just the marketing of the continued marketing of county towns and cities, so that they can continue to get, you know, tourism is a big draw here. So we're looking at a variety of ways to raise more revenue in tight times that we can actually, you know, in our general fund, because it goes into the general fund, and some of it goes back to the, you know, there's also a, you know, a dedicated part of that goes to the tourism and marketing district itself, the folks that do all the advertising. So we're looking at a variety of things like that, putting new fees on things like vacation rentals or even second homes. Because when you look at what's been built here and what are some of the contributing factors to the high cost of living and also the lack of any kind of affordable housing, there's a lot of things, including that a lot of the homes that have been built here are for retirees from out of the area or for people who want second homes, so they don't live here primarily.
How does that raise the cost of living? I don't really get it.
Well, they're willing to pay, obviously, quite a good amount of money for nice homes and nice places, but
okay.
they don't contribute the same. You know, they pay taxes for property taxes, but they don't normally contribute the same as community members do. They're not here all the time. If they're not working as part of the ongoing economy, they're usually not spending and contributing to the same extent that people are too. So you need a mix of everything. And where we've seen, and this has been a while, where we've seen probably some of the threats coming to our community in terms of cost of living is that if you don't have a diversity of ages and professions and people working here, it affects everything from the schools to how much money you're going to have to put back into the communities. You know, everything has gone up, the cost of living. So even the landlords can make a case that everything they have to pay for as well goes up. But the truth is, until we have more units available, right now, I think in the city of San Luis Obispo, something like 65 to almost 70% of the people are renting. That's not really healthy because it does put people in a certain kind of jeopardy sometimes. It can be, you know, in terms of how much things cost right now, I'm not sure it's that much different. And unless you have family money or somebody's going to give you some money, good luck getting enough for a down payment on anything that's for sale. You know, we know that the challenges are big, but if we don't do something about it in a serious way, you know, this is a discussion that we've been having. I've been here now 23 years. I came originally to, you know, teach at Cal Poly. And I have not seen any progress made in the county, at least, from the county board.
So the goal is, okay, we need to build more housing. And
right.
So how is the agreement this week going to achieve that?
Well, one of the ways is to, you know, and this is where you have to look at everything, including trying to address your own processes for housing, which has been part of this package that's been going on. We've looked at areas where we could zone for new housing, where we could have more housing in the county areas, in the county towns, and also collecting more fees on more of the housing that is built, including custom homes, bigger homes, and using that money to put into the affordable housing projects. And probably most effectively, we are committing to at least putting in $2 million a year of general fund money toward housing projects,
Okay. Which
is something that I had proposed in the budget hearings as something we should do to set up this kind of revolving fund. Because there's a lot of projects that, you know, like you mentioned, People Self-Help, Housing Authority, a lot of our nonprofits do these projects, and they're excellent projects. I mean, they build great apartment complexes and small condominium complexes, and the sources of financing for those can come from 6 to sometimes a dozen different sources.
Right.
And sometimes the thing that's lagging between them being built or getting to the next stage is just pure funding. And so if we can actually just say, okay, this is a great project. You know, we've seen projects, you know, right in the area. You know, we don't really have a problem putting the money towards the city or the town. If there's good projects that will help our community have more housing, especially people who are working here, that's what we want this money to go toward.
That was San Luis Obispo County Board Supervisor Adam Hill speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart about the county's new affordable housing plan. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll learn more about some of the environmental aspects of the plan and find out why it's being called historic.
If this is historic and landmark, it's because we've literally done nothing.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We'll be right back. Support for KCBX comes from the Slow Natural Foods Co-op, offering local produce, natural products, and new hot soups and grab-and-go meals made with farm-fresh ingredients. They're at 2494 Victoria Avenue, one block east of Broad at Caudill. Learn more at slonaturalfoods.coop. Welcome back to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Tyler Pratt. Before the break, KCBX's Greta Martin and I were speaking with San Luis Obispo County Board Supervisor Adam Hill about the county's new affordable housing plan. The deal calls for construction fees on larger new homes, streamlining the administrative permitting process, as well as making procedural amendments to the environmental review process. To help better understand the environmental review process, in part two of our interview with Adam Hill, he helped break down the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, as it's commonly called.
And CEQA is an informational document which helps you to determine whether something's going to require a full environmental impact report and cover a variety of areas to something that could be approved, you know, with something as minor as just a mitigated negative declaration, which is doesn't require the same kind of intense review and study. So most of this is set out in state law and handled in court, you know, when there's challenges. So we don't have as much leeway, I would say, at the local level as people might expect. But the developers and builders have proposed some areas, and some of the agents that represent them have proposed some areas where we might be able to move things forward a little bit more quickly. But the real reform on CEQA is going to have to, and it's been talked about for probably as long as the housing process, but probably more seriously over the last 5 to 10 years. But the reform will have to come from the state first. But there's a lot of other things the state's looking at, including by right housing, which would sort of say, once you've zoned for housing and they have, you know, met some basic criteria, you can't stop them from building it. You can't make a discretionary decision against them. You have to, you know, you are almost eliminated from, let's say, whether you're the planning commission or the governing body. You can't just reject a project because 30 people are in the room who hate it. And, you know, that's controversial because it gets into local control. But at the same time, one of the reasons why we are in the situation we're in this community and in all of the communities, I think, in the state now, is because people fight housing all the time. They fight particularly affordable housing, but they fight everything we see. I mean, everything that's been proposed and approved in the city of San Luis, which is the most underhoused in terms of the job balance with housing, that has been fought pretty powerfully by basically people who are retired here.
But people appreciate CEQA because we don't have sprawl. It prevents, mm-hmm. we don't have just ugly, you know, things going up in wetlands,
sure.
and yep. ruining mm-hmm. view sheds. And I mean, CEQA
right.
has a purpose.
Oh, absolutely. I think it has an important purpose. But the argument that gets made, and I think you can make this from any point of view, quite frankly, is that it has crept beyond its original purposes, and it has created more delay, which always costs money, than necessary. Because people can challenge projects, bring them into court, and even though they won't survive the legal challenges, you know, the 6 months to a year that it could take before a project might be adjudicated by a judge, that's going to add a lot of money to projects. So what happens is a lot of, that's been one of the areas, for instance, that people want to look at, is how easily people can make a challenge based on CEQA grounds and get it tied up. Because that's been a strategy that neighborhood groups have used throughout the state.
Right.
Which is, you know, so there is a way that CEQA can be misused, and certainly nobody has proposed that we get rid of it or the essential protections it provides to, you know, to habitats and to species. I mean, I don't think anybody would recommend that. But from where we're at, too, and, you know, I come sort of from the left side of things, I think we have to be open to everything that can get housing built. And also and we'll talk about that as you please, but also in terms of the politics of the board. You know, you have to be realistic about it. And from my perspective, the most important thing is to get some movement, which we have.
So there's a lot of talk right now about this being historic,
yeah.
landmark. There's a lot of handshaking mm-hmm. and backpatting. But is this more feels good right now, but mm-hmm. can the work be done down the line
yeah.
when we really get into the muckety muck?
Well, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of areas, and I warned about that in the meeting too, which is, you know, especially to the coalition of folks who helped to develop this and bring it forward, which was, you know, when some of these things come back individually, they're easier to kill than they are one of the recommendations I had made early on is bring everything together. Because there's going to be stuff that people like and may not like, and that's how compromises are done. But when the stuff comes back individually for votes, whether it be some form of tax or fee increases, we're going to need the support for that because that's how we're going to fund it. I mean, we've made the general commitment, and that is going to be hard to back off of. But if, you know, three members of the board say we don't want to raise any fees or taxes and we're just going to pull that out of the general fund, we will do that. It will just have consequences that we are not necessarily prepared for. You know, my sense is that we would like to raise as much money steadily so that $2 million a year can go up, because the need is that big. That $2 million, which may seem like, you know, obviously it's a lot of money to anybody, but for housing, it's not a lot of money. And we the reason why if this is historic and landmark, it's because we've literally done nothing. You know, in the 10 years since the county board passed its inclusionary housing ordinance, we only raised it once, which was a couple of years ago when Frank Meacham was leaving the board, and we got him to agree to it, and that was a 3-2 vote. And every proposal since then, including the one that I made in budget hearings, which was to shift the board majority's priorities of spending money to housing, and affordable housing didn't pass either. So this is the first time that there has been a commitment, and I think that because, Supervisor Compton was not there, but the other, you know, four of us voted to support it and even mentioned some specifics, which was, for my sense, it was good that particularly the more conservative supervisors talked about some specifics that, you know, they haven't seemed to be too warm to before.
What can be done to help these items individually moving forward where they don't just get knocked off and next thing you're left with a shell of a plan?
Well, we're going to need the same support from the folks that you know, and I've told that to the coalition, to the leaders of these, you know, different groups, which is we're going to, you know, hopefully you can use this goodwill to enlist more people to help. Because I think the more people come out and the more support there is, that's always better. I mean, nobody was opposing this because it's policy. And, of course, I think what you're kind of getting at, which is, well, what about when these actually become projects that go into neighborhoods? And that is where you see the biggest challenges. Because, as I said before, it has become really much customary now in our community and a lot of nicer communities like San Luis Obispo, but throughout the state, for neighborhood groups to oppose because they don't want to see more housing. They don't want to see density. They don't want to see changes in views. You know, there's a couple of things that can get in the way of projects actually getting built as what they call affordable by design, which I think is impossible right now. And that's what we're looking at with some of the CEQA and process improvements, because you can also get, you know, the like you've seen in the city of San Luis Obispo, I think the council members have stuck their neck out to do the right thing. And certainly that means people are going to be mad at you and you're going to lose friends and supporters. But the next part of it is, how does that get processed by staff and everybody else between the approvals and when the stuff actually gets built? And that is a really nebulous area. And that is what we hear all the time in terms of complaints about, you know, why things are taking too long or why things are being asked or why more fees are being derived. So by the time all of that happens, that's gonna figure into the, you know, to the cost of the units that are being sold. And that's where you find the real difficulty.
What's next?
So for us, what's next is we will have some of these items brought back as to putting, because some of the stuff we have to put on the ballot, say in 2020, some of the fee and tax increases, which again, we've really focused on people who do not live here. So on tourists and, you know, visitors, people who may own second homes, and even people who may have very big custom homes built. And so some of that we'll have to, you know, we'll need support for that to put it on the ballot and to try to get people to support that.
But what specifically, besides these ballot things, what can we look for in 2019 specific items?
You know, people will want to make sure that the board lives up. You know, if we're going to celebrate or pat ourselves on the back for this being historic and a breakthrough and a landmark, et cetera, well, you know, the rubber meets the road with the money. And, you know, there should be a continual commitment to help fund projects and to also to find land that is suitable for affordable housing and to work with, you know, everybody we have to work with to get it approved. Sometimes you find land, and you see, this is part of the process that the state's trying to crack down on with the local governments, which is zoning for land is not the same thing as approving it. And what they're saying is, if you zone for things, if you say you have to, like the state gives you numbers about how many units you should plan for and how many of them should be in different economic distributions. And so if you're planning for this many lower income or workforce housing units, but you're not building them, they're going to crack down on that. They're going to find cities and counties, and they're going to actually help developers build those things by right, rather in sort of almost bypass the local control. And that's the controversy. But that's no longer, I think, a veiled threat. What we've seen with legislation that's gone through the, you know, last few years in the legislature, some of it's been killed at the end, but I think that it's no longer a threat. I think there's an understanding, well, if the local governments don't do it, then the state government's going to have to.
Supervisor Adam Hill, thank you for coming in.
My pleasure. Yeah.
Thank you. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. You'll be able to hear that interview with Adam Hill shortly over on our website, kcbx.org. Well, many of us have holiday traditions that date back decades, and some are starting new traditions. Artist and professor Krissa Hewitt's fruitcake tradition goes back at least 50 years. Father Ian Dellinger joined Hewitt this month to cook Krissa's Christmas cake on this month's Playing with Food.
It's December, and it's fruitcake weather. In 1956, novelist, short story writer, screenwriter, playwright, and actor Truman Capote published his short story, A Christmas Memory, in Mademoiselle magazine.
It's always the same. A morning arrives in November, and my friend, as though officially inaugurating the Christmas time of year that exhilarates her imagination and fuels the blaze of her heart, announces, "It's fruitcake weather. Fetch our buggy. Help me find my hat."
The autobiographical story is set in the 1930s when the 7-year-old Capote and his elderly distant cousin and best friend embark on the annual task of gathering the ingredients and baking fruitcake. Cal Poly Professor Emeritus Krissa Hewitt has a similar annual tradition. She graciously allowed the Playing with Food crew into her kitchen to share the experience with her and her college hallmate, Nancy. This is how it went.
I'm Krissa Hewitt. I am a faculty emeritus from Cal Poly Art and Design Department, where I taught jewelry design, sculpture, three-dimensional design, a few other things tagged along for 31 years. I'm about to start making fruitcake, which I think my mom and I started it in 1960.
You're getting ready for Christmas.
Correct. Its history is that my mom was sent a fruitcake one year with the usual expectation of, what do I want to eat this for? It's fruitcake.
You found it in the cupboard five years later.
And she decided, you know, this is pretty darn good. And it was sent by a family member, and her father's family came from Chillicothe, Ohio. And so there was a woman in that town who started making fruitcake and selling it and getting a livelihood off of it. My mom thought it was good enough, and she wrote back to the relative and said, is there any chance that this woman would share the recipe? I live a couple thousand miles away. I'm not going to be making it as a living. So the woman did. And it was a handwritten note, which may still be around here someplace. So that's where we started. And this is my copy, not the original.
Oh, wow.
So this makes now 14 of the commercial regular loaf pan, not the little tiny gift ones.
So we've got a lot of raisins.
Yes.
both regular and white raisins. Dates, cherries, pineapple, citron, orange peel, lemon peel, pecans, almonds, and flour.
This year I treated myself to ordering online. I thought, I don't need to drive to 5 markets to find nothing.
Okay, well let's get started and tell me what you want me to do.
Okay, what I have done, because the recipe told us to do this, is that all the fruit has been cut up and allowed to sit for a while together with a little flour on it. It's in a pan over there.
Oh, wow. But it's not soaking in alcohol.
No. Recipe calls for 1 glass of brandy. No description
for
of size.
For 14 cakes, it's only 1 glass of brandy?
Part of the thing about fruitcakes is most people need to soak them in something to make them taste good. This one actually tastes really good. I'm not a heavy drinker, so when everybody talks about, well, I, you know, just keep soaking this, and I'm going, just taste it once. Without all of it. Okay, so 1 pound of butter.
Okay, with your nifty little butter cutter.
Well, it's just to make the beating a little easier. Okay, you can start emptying brown sugar if you want.
Okay, is it the whole thing?
Yeah, that one and this one.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
This is a really big bowl.
This is a really big bowl. My sister found this bowl someplace years ago, so it's been great. It doesn't get used a lot. If I had a major salad course at some meal, that would be perfect.
How fluffed do you want this?
We're just beginning.
Oh, you're adding more stuff in.
Okay, I think you can turn that off for now and we'll get the eggs going.
So is this a special brandy?
No.
It's a big bottle of brandy.
I'm using this glass because it's one that Mom used to drink bourbon out of all the time.
A whole glass?
That's good.
Okay.
Perfect. Conveniently, this is the amount we need.
Of molasses?
Mm-hmm. Which is a whole jar of...
It is convenient when it comes in. You just have to rip open the packages and
right. Not
measure anything. So this recipe makes 14 cakes. Do you just really enjoy it, or do you inflict it on your loved ones?
Fortunately, I've learned people that really love it. And I have some here, actually, one that didn't get used last year that's in very good shape, so you can taste it.
There we go. Oh, wow, it's wrapped in gauze and everything.
Yeah, I wrap it in cheesecloth that I've soaked in brandy and then in foil.
So this was made a year ago?
Correct.
Do you always do it the Sunday after Thanksgiving?
That became kind of the tradition, especially when I was away at school, but I think even before that, because it meant I was there and other people were around as opposed to Mom just getting stuck doing it.
Okay, let me take a taste of it. Not bad.
You sound surprised.
Well, you know, I went to high school in the Midwest around all of these German families. You know, you would get fruitcake upon fruitcake upon fruitcake, and it was all really sickeningly sweet. This is very moist, and the commercial ones were not moist at all.
That's why they got all the reputation of being a doorstop or a brick
exactly.
Or, you know, whatever.
But this is good. I ate a whole slice.
Okay. What's the status on the eggs, Nancy?
The eggs are ready to do whatever.
All right. Well, bring the yolks over here. Beat them up a little bit.
Okay.
Are we beating egg whites?
Yes.
Now or later?
Now's fine.
Is this all the dried spices?
Mm-hmm.
The smell of Christmas right there?
Exactly. One year I got this all ready to go and set it aside and then forgot to put it in. It was different. It wasn't bad, but it was different. Okay, so all of that goes in the big bowl.
In goes the buttermilk.
In goes the buttermilk. We did the brandy already. So the laborious part of this is cutting up the fruit.
Okay.
Cutting up dates, getting the pits out. You just become sticky, it feels like, all the way up to your elbow.
And I missed that activity.
Yeah, because it was done the day before.
Okay. How's that for right now?
That looks great. Okay.
Some nice fluffy egg whites. You said you taught art and design for 31 years at Cal Poly.
Yes.
How did you discover Cal Poly?
Fortunately, it was the job that accepted me.
Okay.
I grew up in Los Angeles in the San Fernando Valley, but most of my travels actually took me to the East Coast where my father was born, and he moved to California, but we always went back to see his family. So going to San Francisco or Santa Barbara or regular trips like that didn't happen very often. I still remember when I came for my interview going, "This ain't bad." It happened to be April, so the hills were green, and, you know, I was in Michigan at the time going to graduate school. So I sent out resumes to probably about 200 schools just because, you know, most of them didn't have jobs. But this one did, and it was one of the few that was a full-time tenure-track position as opposed to a sabbatical. I think teaching was kind of always a part of what I realized I was going to do. Making art and trying to sell it and make a living is damn hard work, and fortunately I like teaching, so it wasn't a bad thing to be doing as a substitute to that. The other joy of that has always been that I can take on commissions, which I do, but I am not beholden to the current trends in terms of trying to make stuff that will sell.
Teaching art and design for 31 years, what changed in your approach?
Actually, one of the interesting things that was changing was watching how the students were less and less and less familiar with their physical environment and how to manipulate it. They didn't know how to use tools. They, you know, it was like everything was kind of foreign. And that was an interesting shift. It made me very concerned about, you know, what's going on. I had to take a lot more time trying to explain how to use a hammer, how to use a file. Okay, gets dumped in here.
Okay, I'll lift the bowl and you can scrape. Well, I don't know if I want to lift the bowl because I don't want to be responsible for breaking it.
Yeah, you can rest it on the pan.
Okay. It's like a lava flow.
Yes, getting the smell of the molasses and a little bit of the brandy. Now the joy. This is a nice one of the flat ice cream scoops. If I tried to use a spoon, I'd be kind of too far out of the action and wouldn't work very well. It's just a matter of trying to get it well mixed. And this pan is also special in that it is the liner from one of the old, I think it was a Hamilton Beach portable little oven that my mom would roast a ham in or whatever. One Thanksgiving or Christmas, somehow in the cleanup, the electrical cord got dispatched to someplace unknown. Unfortunately, she was smart enough to save the liner, which we had already started using as the mixing pan, and it would be really hard without it because it's 7 inches, 8 inches deep, and if you were trying to do this as I did once in like a lobster kettle or something, it's very hard to get to the bottom. So I really appreciate this pan.
I'm very much a process person. I really like the doing of things. So whether it's cooking, especially in baking, I often see my mother's hands at the end of my arm, peeling an apple or whatever. What I started learning initially from her was baking. And baking, you have to be systematic. You can't just start at the far end and work backwards. And you can't very well in jewelry and metal either. You have to be able to plan the steps or at least know that there are steps. And my hunch is that finding metal as a discipline may have had some similarity. I've always enjoyed just doing things physically that way. So when the piece is done, when the fruitcake is done, it's nice to eat it, but it was more fun making it. Okay, so now we're going to alternate 6 cups of flour and a dozen egg whites. I don't know when I was conscious of visualizing necessarily. My father loved to make things to teach himself how to do things. Unfortunately, he died when I was 8, so I didn't get anywhere near enough of that. But I got enough to say, this is fun. And the other great thing was, is that, you know, as a 6 and 7, 8-year-old, I wasn't somebody that he would say, run along, kid, I'm busy. I could always be right there underfoot. And I remember he was tooling some leather. And so then I got to hold the tool while he would maybe hit or something. And then eventually he was helping me learn how to do that. My parents had a swimming pool built. And he came home from work one day and he handed each of us a very simple sailboat kit. So we put those together and they sort of worked. Tended to fall over in the water with the sail, but the idea was good. But I asked him one day, I said, can we do another boat? Can I do something a little bit more than what we did before? And so it's like, fine. So we went off to the hobby store, and I remember that he was so frustrated because the only models that were there that were at all appropriate for a 7 or 8-year-old were plastic already. This was in 1955, 56. So he just went over to the balsa wood area and got chunks of that and then took them home, taught me how to shape the hull of a boat all from scratch.
So he, in a few short 8 years, he was able to impart the rest of your life onto you.
Yes. As I say, he always enjoyed creating. He always enjoyed teaching himself how to do things, much more inquisitive than I think I have ever been. So that impression was left, and also just the, you know, certainly his presence after death in terms of just memories and everything else was there as an inspiration.
What's it like trying to teach people to have a vision of what they want to build? I'd imagine that'd be kind of difficult because you don't know what's in their head.
Correct.
And they don't know what's in your head. And you're like, build this magnificent piece of sculpture.
In the jewelry classes, I had some initial exercises that taught them something about how to cut the metal, how to file it, how to bend it, so that maybe that could stimulate some sense of where they could go with it. And then their first project, everyone was making a ring or a necklace. It was their pattern or their idea. And my requirement was is that I have a consultation with each of them individually about what they were trying to make so that they would bring a drawing. And a big part of that was is that metal is not very forgiving in some ways. And if you have no idea what it can do, you're either going to design totally inappropriately or get yourself really caught. At that stage, I could help them figure out if you change this just a little bit, life will get a whole lot easier, or whatever it might be. But mostly, I think it's just trying to give enough structure so that they weren't just totally, I have no idea what to do, and at the same time, enough freedom so that they were, if there were 24 students, there were 24 different rings. We've done a really good job in this culture, I think, of making art feel like it's something that belongs only to a few. Born with the gene or you're not is the concept, which I personally think is hogwash. And so it's just trying to get people beyond that.
Well, it's getting thicker, definitely. Have you ever made 2 batches?
Yes. In fact,
this batch is going to Sandy Sigurdsson, who several years ago got so excited about this cake. So she comes and cuts up fruit with me. Would have been here today, but couldn't fit it into her schedule. This one she will have, and then I'll do another one that'll be mine. This is more energy than I've expended in a long time. I'm standing here perspiring. God, that batch is good. You want to try mixing?
No. I think you're doing a good job.
Don't want to take the fun away.
Do you think in all those years of teaching, you changed as an artist?
I hope so. I think probably mostly in terms of just broadening my sense of exploration of shapes and forms, and not quite sure what started it, but got very interested in kind of natural textures and age of things. So that didn't always come out in the pieces per se, but I did find myself putting more textural forms into pieces of jewelry and other things, whereas, you know, kind of started out as polished metal.
Do you think you learned from any of your students?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think not only learning things, but learning how to try to communicate, how to inspire, and I don't have any easy answers for how to describe that, but I hope I improved over the years. Okay.
You're getting there.
I'm getting there.
Try?
Yeah, just distribute that a little bit.
Other than this cake, are you an avid cook at all?
Oh, yes. I like to cook. When you live by yourself, you don't tend to do lots of extravagant kind of things, or at least I don't. So when there's an occasion to do a holiday or some other kind of thing, then I put it together. And I had somebody the other day saying, well, instead of that party, why don't you do it as a potluck and that'll make it easier on you? And I'm going, how do I explain this to you? I mean, the thing is that when I do a party like that, it's a gift. My fun is the doing of it. It's not that I dislike potlucks, but that's not the purpose on that one.
Well, it looks good. The time has come to plop it into the pans. And you've got an enormous oven. Can you fit all of them in the oven?
Yes.
So I see that the pan is not... Oh, the pans are buttered and then lined, right?
Yeah, parchment paper. Oh, yeah, they can all be much closer to this, but down in the corners and everything else. So you've got room to go.
Yep.
You know, I'm trying to kind of smooth it out, so. But I also don't want to overwork it, so.
So there we go, and you've shown me the final product. What is the most special thing to you about making this, or eating this, or sharing this cake?
That it was something that Mom and I started doing, and sitting there and cutting up the fruit and having sticky cherries and dates and everything stuck all the way up your arm, it seemed. And I certainly am very fond of traditions. In fact, I was thinking this morning, and I went and got the Truman Capote book and his childhood making fruitcake with this, as he said, very distant cousin. Just the whole, you know, story about going out and picking the pecans off the ground that had fallen from the trees that had been harvested, and they had no money and all of the kind of things. It's carried a lot of the same feel of the importance of just doing something with people you love.
Chris's holiday fruitcake tradition so closely paralleled Truman Capote's A Christmas Memory. I realized that the common thread between them, the common thread in all traditions we hold dear to our hearts, is love.
The black stove, stoked with coal and firewood, glows like a lighted pumpkin. Egg beaters whirl, spoons spin round in bowls of butter and sugar. Vanilla sweetens the air, ginger spices it, melting, nose-tingling odors saturate the kitchen, suffuse the house, drift out to the whirl on puffs of chimney smoke. In four days, our work is done.
31 cakes, dampened with whiskey, bask on the window sills and shelves. Who are they for? Friends?
Happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays. May your family traditions be as rich and fulfilling and filled with the love that memories make as Chris's. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all of our guests and contributors this week. I'm Tyler Pratt. From all of us here at KCBX, happy holidays. Issues and Ideas will be on break until the new year. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon beginning January 7th for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org. Thank you.